But he lived in a world that was quite different from ours. And sadly, his dad died when he was very young, just a young boy. And that made life very difficult for his mum, because she didn't have enough money to look after the family. He was the eldest. And what happens nowadays when you're 12? What happens at school, James Haxton? When you're 12, where do you go? Correct, up to high school. Well, James McPhee didn't go to high school. It's weird, really, to think of him. At the age of 12, he had to go and get a job. So instead of going to school, James, secondary school, you're going out, you're going to get a job. You've got no qualifications. I wonder what kind of thing you would like to do when you grow up. Any of the girls at the front, what would you like to do when you grow up, when you leave school? A teacher, good one. Anyone else? Anyone else got jobs? Any of you girls, the cool girls over here? What do you want to do when you leave school? Any ideas? Don't be shy. A midwife, very good, very good. Yes, a doctor, wow. Aiming high, that's good, that'll do just now. Thank you. There will be some opportunities for interaction, and that's good that you're able to help us out with that as we go along. Well, James sadly didn't have that kind of option to be a doctor or a midwife or any of these good jobs. This was what he ended up doing. It wasn't in a barbershop trio or whatever that's called. What was that kind of job? What do you think they did? They weren't gangsters either. Coal miners, that's right. At 12 years old, imagine James Haxton going off Morag to work in the coal mines to bring in money for your family. James, you're signed up. You're signed up. But imagine hot work, horrible work for a little boy of 12 down the mines with the men in a smoky atmosphere and all the dust. A really horrible job. A job I certainly would not want. He became one of the lads. He was just an ordinary guy. And I was thinking about the world then. The world, I initially thought the world was so much bigger then, but I guess in a lot of ways it was so much smaller, because people didn't really go out of where they lived very much, certainly not like today. Who's been abroad to another country this year? That would be good, wouldn't it? Thank you, Ruth. Ruth has already been to another country. Colin's been to England. In the last year, anyone been abroad? In the last year? Yeah, oh yeah, I've been abroad. Lots of people go abroad because that's what people are able to do nowadays. But when James McPhee was young, hardly anyone could afford to travel abroad. There was no planes, there was no cars, and any transport was far too expensive. And the thought of going away to somewhere, I don't know, somewhere exotic like Africa was just impossible for someone like James. It was an impossible dream. But a few miles from where James was born and grew up, lived just before him a guy who was very famous indeed. You've already seen his name up. Did anyone spot it before we started? David Livingstone, that's right. David Livingstone. And David Livingstone was a very famous man. I wonder who likes adventure movies. Who knows this one? Clive's not in this one, I don't think. Maybe somewhere in the background. Just in case he pops up and goes, I was in that movie. Yeah, Indiana Jones, he is a brilliant action hero, isn't he? He was an adventurer. And he would go into the unknown, he would get into dangerous places, and he would get caught up in all kinds of exciting scrapes. But David Livingstone was a real life hero, and an action hero, and an explorer. And he was very well known throughout the world, but particularly in Scotland, because he was one of the first men who traveled to Africa to look for the source of the river. Any guesses? Nile, that's right. The source of the River Nile. But you know, people in Scotland, it was so exciting for them to hear of David Livingstone and all the things that he was up to. And he wrote books about his travels, and other books were written about him too. And James McPhee must have dreamt to have a life like that, rather than being stuck down a mine shaft underground. And he would read all about David Livingstone's exploits and even walk over to the house where David Livingstone was born and have a look round and just think, wow, imagine a guy from here going all the way out to Africa. And for him, dream on. But as the years went on, one of his workmates was called Davy Walker. He was a Christian. He was different from the other men who were coal miners. He didn't swear. He didn't get drunk like they did. And he often spoke to James about his faith in Jesus. As I say, he was different from all the others. And James liked him, and they got on well together. And so one day he went along with Davy Walker to hear someone speaking in a church. And soon after this, James made a decision to follow Jesus. He asked Jesus into his heart and gave his life to follow him. But he had no idea where that was going to lead. Sometimes men would come to the church where he went, missionaries from places like Africa, and tell us stories of all the things that they were doing out there. And it really excited him. And it started, something began to burn in his heart for Africa. And maybe he began to think, if someone like David Livingstone could do it, maybe someone like me could do it as well. He had a real desire to tell people about Jesus, and also he wanted to go out to Africa and go to these tribes and villages, because he thought, if no one tells them, how are they going to know? How are they going to know the good news? How are they going to come to know Jesus if nobody tells them? But what could he do? What age was he when he left school? 12, that's right. He was practically illiterate. He could hardly read and write. But one of his old teachers heard about it. He'd become a headmaster by this stage, and he came alongside James McPhee and sat down with him and helped him to learn good English, to study good English, because he knew that would help him when it came to learn other languages. He was a great help, and James made good progress. But also, going away into Africa, I needed some skills. Maybe some of the adults could help. What kind of skills might he need if he's going to go out to Africa? If he's going to get start up from scratch out there? And say again? Carpentry is a good one, yep. Lion taming, yeah, we'll come to that. We'll come to that later. There's always one, isn't there? And there's always more ag. But, yeah, so that was him. And he needed to learn some skills, so a bit of carpentry, a bit of building, and also he had to start saving up money to go to Africa. How would he get there? How would he get to Africa over 100 years ago? By boat, that's right. How much do you think it costs for a ticket to Africa? Return ticket by boat. How much? £100, that's a good guess. We're going, I'm not going to tell you higher or lower. Let's take another guess first. Say again? A year's wages. Okay, a bit less than that and a bit more than that. £200 is a good guess, but we're going lower than 200. 150, we're going way lower than that. James? Right, one last guess. We're going to have to go way down from that. Close, very close. You're sixpence out. No, not ten, sixpence. £10. £10 return to Africa on a boat. But you know, I looked it up and checked it out, and that was worth about £1,000 back then. So it was a lot of money for people to save up to go up, off to Africa. And so James got people behind him to support him, his church, and people started to give, and time went on, and it took a long time, and then he finally felt ready to go. And he decided he wanted to follow in the footsteps of David Livingstone. And when he went to meet with an organization to tell him about what he was going to do, they needed to support him and give him their backing. They said, no way, no way are you going to Africa. You're practically illiterate. You only know about English. You left school at 12. You want to... No, forget it. And also, you're too young. It was a real disappointment for James. But do you know what? He was very determined. And he thought, that isn't going to put me off. Because he believed this was what God wanted him to do. Wonder how you would feel to leave your family and your friends way back then and go off to an unknown country, an unknown part of the world. How might you feel? How might you feel? A mixture of things. James? Say again? Homesick, yeah. Scary, that's right. You'd be scared. And also a little bit excited, that's right. A little bit excited. What's going to happen out there? It's going to be a different world, slightly different world from Bells Hill, having lived there for 20 years. There were some similarities. But He came to the station to leave, and there was a crowd of people to see him off, and in that crowd was a woman called Janet Anderson. And James had a real soft spot for Janet. He was in love with Janet, and he wanted to marry her, but he was leaving her at this stage, and he was going off to Africa, and I'm sure he was quite sad about that, but she was planning to go and meet him, and so she went off to study at the missionary medical school, so that when she went out with him to Africa, that she would be helpful when they got there as well. So James is on the train, and he starts chatting to people. There was a couple with a young daughter who was handicapped, and he was telling them about what he was wanting to do, where he was going, and they were quite taken with it. And this daughter, who was grown up, spoke to her parents and gave him a gift of half a crown. Was that a lot of money, Leslie? Yeah. Quite a lot of money. 25p. 25p. But back then, an awful lot more than that. And for James, that was a sign that God was going to provide for him along the way. And for a man like James, growing up always known as Bells Hill and maybe Blantyre, to arrive in Southampton and find something as massive as this, a huge big ship, probably bigger than anything that he'd ever seen, bigger than any building that he'd ever seen, I'm sure that was quite overwhelming for him to see that sight. What kind of people do you think travelled on a ship like this? Say it again at the back. Wait a wee second. Well-to-do, that's right. People that had a bit of money, and not like James. So he got on board, and he was on the cheapest way to travel, and it was called steerage. Ian, do you know what steerage is? What's that? Yeah, pretty much right at the bottom. Right at the bottom, so you go down past all people's nice apartments, and you keep on going down and down until you get right into the bottom of the boat. A big space full of bunks, and he'd got all his gear on board that he'd brought with him, and he spoke to the steward, and he said, "Which bunk's mine?" And the steward says, "You can have your pick, mate. There's no one else coming under here except you." So he had that whole area to himself, and then the steward said, "And by the way, we're not going to cook specially for you. Just you come up and eat with all the posh people upstairs, and just don't let on." So he was quite happy to do that. And until he went up for his first meal. So he's sitting there and the waiter brings him the menu, which looks very nice. Looks, can you see what that says? It's in French. He doesn't know any French. He only knows a little bit of English. And he kind of looks at it and the waiter says, "Where are you from?" He says, "I'm from Glasgow." And the waiter says, "I'm from Glasgow too." And he could see from James's face he didn't have a clue what this said. And he said, "Listen, when I bring the menu round, I'll just point to something. And you say, 'Oh, that would be very nice, sir.' And everything will be fine. I'll look after you on board the ship." So that was another person that he met on the way. On board also was a rich man. And he was a big game hunter. He wasn't looking for Trivial Pursuit or Monopoly or anything like that. He was looking for shooting lions, maybe tigers. I don't know what he was going out to Africa to shoot for. But he was excited to hear James' story. And he said to James, "I'm going to make you an offer. You come with me and I'll make you rich. I'll give you lots of money and you'll have great adventure. Come with me." And James was not to be deflected. I'm sure it might have been tempting for him. But he says, "Thank you for your offer, but I'm not going to do that." How long do you think it takes to fly across the world today? About a day. Somebody was telling me this week at Toddlers, flying to Sydney, 21 hours on a plane. 7 to Dubai, 14 to Australia. That's a long haul, isn't it? Back then, on a boat, getting to Africa, how many days? 6 weeks, a wee bit less than that. 4 weeks, not bad. 23 days, a long time at sea. But finally, they docked in Africa in a place called Lobito. And that's, again, a little bit different from Bells Hill and Southampton. And the day he arrived in Lobito, something very dramatic happened in the world 100 years ago. First World War broke out. And he didn't know what that would mean, but it meant that he wouldn't be able to come back home for 6 years from Africa until it was safe to travel. But there was English people lived in Lobito, and James stayed for a little while with them to learn from them about what was going on in Africa, a little bit about the culture. And then he got the train. This is a train from Lobito. It's quite a dramatic looking train, isn't it? Out in Africa, coming out from Lobito. And that went right into Africa, as far as it would go, to the end of the line. Then it stopped, thankfully. And from there, he had to get out with all his stuff, and it was going to be a long walk all the way into Angola. The journey was about 500 miles, and it was going to be a long walk. Okay, he had far too much to carry. He looked around, did all his stuff, but he knew what he had to do. How was he going to carry all that stuff 500 miles through the jungle into the middle of Africa? What's he going to do? Benjamin. Daniel. Yeah, someone to help. And there they were, the carriers, people who would help carry all the gear along the way as they went. So that was really important, because I was thinking there was no tom-toms back then apart from the tom-tom drums, and there was no accurate maps, but he had Livingstone's diary and some maps that maybe Livingstone had roughly drawn. And we've got pretty good roads in Scotland in general, apart from the speed bumps and some of the holes. But in Africa, they were paths at the best. And it was really slow progress through the jungle and through the countryside as well. What would the weather be like? Yeah, it was boiling hot. Absolutely boiling. And so tiring to walk. And James had one pair of boots. And he made a decision when he set out, he was going to keep those boots good. And so he tied them together and he put them around his neck and he carried them around his neck until he was going to meet a chief or another white person. He put his boots on, looked the part, but kept his boots good. And the story is told that when he came home with my dad went with him to the chiropodist. And when he came out, my grandpa was smiling and my dad says, "Why are you smiling?" He says, "The chiropodist looked at my feet and says, you obviously don't do much walking." So God looked after his feet as well all that time when he was out in Africa. I wonder what he made of the alien world that he found out there. Some white people had gone out before and built their little huts, and James had to go out and build his as well. But imagine no electricity. What would you miss with no electricity? No. Light is good. Kids, what could you not live without? A washing machine, well done. What would you miss if you had no electricity?
Match of the day.
Match of the day. Yeah, exactly. Really important things like that. Cooking, fridges, all these things. You had nothing because you had no electricity. No supermarkets, no cars, no buses, no trains. And you want to go anywhere, you had to walk. I wonder what they would eat back then. The most common thing was called mush. It tastes exactly as it sounds. Because I remember growing up, my dad would get the materials and go back to his childhood, make some mush for himself. It looked exactly like wallpaper paste, and I think tasted pretty much the same. It was pretty nasty stuff. But they had some good food. They had fresh bananas, and they had fish that they could catch in the river. They would have chicken and eggs. I don't know which came first. They had honey, they had flour, they had sweet potatoes and turnip and something called Makolo. And Makolo was like an orange, but really weird. Has anyone heard of Makolo before? It was like a nut and you broke it open and inside was like an orange inside this nut, but it seemed to be very delicious. What would you eat, miss eating if you had to be out there? What's your favorite food that you would miss?
Pineapple?
You might even get pineapples out there. That would be good for you. I think I would miss so many, not vegetables, but lots of other things. Steak pie, yep. Chocolate, You'd certainly miss chocolate as well. So, let's see this little river, because James arrived at the banks of this river, the Zambezi River, where David Livingstone got to, and it was in a place called Kazombo in Angola. Looks quite a nice part of the world, doesn't it, Judea? But sometimes, and quite often, the river was too fast, it was too wide, and it was too dangerous. What is in the river? Yeah, you can see the eyes looking out. It's hippos, very dangerous. And so to get down the river, James knew they would need a good boat to travel in. How would you make a boat? Say again? Wood, that's right. Where'd you get the wood? Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you can't tell the wood from the trees, but that's correct. And this is exactly what James did. He got this, just like that, a huge big tree, and my dad said it was 30 feet long. What length is this hole, Colin? About 50? So about half the length of this church and about 5 foot wide, and it would take 7 people would stand and they would paddle this hold-out canoe down the river, and in the middle there would be a shelter for them and somewhere to store the gear as they traveled down the river. And there was dry seasons and there was rainy seasons, and when it was dry, James would take some of the carriers and he would go and visit the African villages to tell people about Jesus, travel hundreds of miles on foot around the countryside to all these villages. It was tough to travel, and we'll come back to that shortly. And when he came to the villages, there would just be small, sometimes just 10 huts, and with his translator, and as he learned the language, he would tell them that they were going to go to a bigger village further on and encourage them to come that evening, and they were going to build a big fire, and they were going to have a sing-song, sing-along, teach them some songs, and tell them about Jesus when they were there. So people were glad to come. It was quite exciting for them. And the fire was also good, not just for a bit of heat in the colder evenings. What else is the big fires good for? Anyone? Campfire songs, that's right. Keep the wild animals at bay, that's right. And so aside from wild animals, there were some pretty wild people. People like this, witch doctors and frightened tribes people who'd never seen a white person before, and they were worried about what this white person might do to them. But they began to have meetings, and they loved to tell the natives all about Jesus. And some, usually about 50 to 60 of the natives would come and gather around and listen. And I have got some of the actual diaries that my grandma wrote at the time later on when she went out of their adventures that were there. But James was determined. He wanted to change the way that the natives lived. And so he bought some seed and sold it to them and showed them how to plant it and grow their own crops so they could eat and they could sell them and they could buy clothes and they were able to buy other food and live for themselves, because the soil was really good and the crops grew really well. They made their huts. Here's their huts. Slightly different from our houses, huts that looked like that, just made out of mud, but they weren't very strong, because when the rainy season came, they would start to dissolve a bit in the horrible weather. And so James would teach them how to do a bit of thatching on the top. He'd make bricks out of mud, but leave them to bake in the sun, and then build up the huts for them. But you know, over there, people would get sick from all kinds of diseases, because the water that they would drink would often be dirty water, and so it was difficult for the people there. But James and his friends would try to help with the little medicine that he'd brought with him. But there was a spring in the hillside, and it ran down right down to the river, and James was able to get a hose, and he was able to buy from the traders a big tank, not for driving, a big water tank, and redirect the water into the tank, which meant that people didn't have to go all the way down to the river. And also, when it was a drier season, there was plenty of water stored up for the people. So that was something that was really helpful for them. But 6 years has gone by, and the war is over, and it's time to go back home. Wonder who you like to see when you get back home. If you've been away yourself, maybe at a camp, you can't wait to see your parents, you can't wait to see your family, you can't wait to see your friends. And James couldn't wait to see Janet, that's right, when he got back. How do you send messages nowadays? Some of you guys over there texting, anything else? What do you use? Texting? Skyping, yep. Correct. Snap. I've even got that in my notes there. Snapchat. If some of you don't know what that is, just ask them later. Maybe you just pick up your normal phone or go on your mobile. Everything happens in an instant. Or if you're old-fashioned, you send a fax and even emails. But even a letter today goes pretty quick to the other side of the world. But back then, it took 6 weeks for a letter to get delivered from Africa. Postmen, they do a lot of walking here. But out there, every week, they would send a man to walk to Rhodesia to collect the mail and the goods 150 miles. Go and get the post 150 miles away. What a long time to communicate back and forward. And while James was back home, he got married to Janet, and he went round the country to give reports of the work that he was doing, try and raise money to develop the work out there. He wanted to have a clinic for Janet and get medicine and supplies to make a difference for the natives who were often so sick. But it's scary enough back then for a man to go to Africa, but for a woman, it must have been terrifying. And this time they sailed off together. They repeated the journey that James had made when he went the first time, and she was quite worried about wildlife. Margaret won't go to Australia with me because of creepy crawlies. Well, Africa's a different story. That was really scary to be going out there. I was thinking it's like living in a zoo without any fences to keep you safe. But early on, as they traveled in the jungle, they pitched their tent, and during the night, there was the most terrible noise. The most terrible noise, and they were really panicked and wondered what was going on. It was pitch dark. And in the morning, when the light came up and they looked out their tents, they found that there had been an elephant stampede during the night, and the trees had just been knocked out the way, and they'd come through and they'd gone round their tents and kept on going, and they were safe. And for her, that was so important in those early days to say, yeah, God is going to look after us. Not spiders and wee creepy crawlies, but blinking elephants charging at you in the middle of the night. And God was able to protect her in that situation. That gave her great faith. But for traveling, this was a helpful way for her to be able to travel. If it was needed and she got wearied, then she could hop in there and get carried along, and that would make the journey a little bit easier. A bit better, Morag, for you? Think so? Yeah, that's good. And so they would, when she got there, they would travel around the country often together, and she walked that 500 miles as well at the end of that train journey right into the middle of Africa. Over the years, they would come to the villages, and the people would come out, they'd welcome James McPhee, and they would shout, Nala Mafu. That was his nickname. I can't remember what it means, but it wasn't anything nasty. But they didn't always get a warm welcome, though. In other places, as I said before, they were frightened. They were particularly frightened. They'd never seen a white woman before. And she would just smile at them, and usually they found that did the trick. And when they would travel, they would meet really different kinds of people. They'd meet a chief with 15 wives. Can you imagine 15 wives, Clive? 15 wives. That is something else. And they'd have to face up to these witch doctors. And in the notes in her diary, she was talking about how she and James would stand up boldly against these powerful witch doctors and proclaim the truth of the gospel. And she would tell exciting stories of crossing wild rivers while looking for the hippos and what else in the river? Crocodiles as well, that's right. And once when they were out, they spotted a little nest in the ground. And there was 15 eggs buried in the sand, two more layers underneath, and they were crocodile eggs. And so it was decided by James and the men, we need to smash these eggs because that's going to be a lot of crocodiles in the river. And so some of the men made a lot of noise to keep the crocodiles away. The rest of them started to smash the eggs. And as they were smashing them, some of them started to hatch, and they came out with their teeth. They're pretty small, but they've got a nasty wee bite to them. And they were able to deal with that situation at that stage. And we actually had one in our house, a little stuffed crocodile that my dad brought back from Africa. And it had quite a big mouth and horrible wee teeth. And that was the kind of threats that they had as they went along. In the jungle, the paths sometimes were just wide enough for one person to hack their way through the long grass and the branches, and progress was very slow. Other times, she would write about how they would get caught in sinking sand and start to sink down and have to get pulled out. Pretty scary stuff. But there was also great beauty as they went. There was lovely, bright flowers like these up in the trees, and huge, huge trees and animals, great and small, and all the noises that would go on in the jungle. The River Zambezi is one of the greatest rivers in the world. And as they went, they were able to, as I said earlier on, get some fresh bananas and cook the fish. And even this is what she wrote. The people here have a nice lot of edible caterpillars. After the caterpillars have eaten every leaf on the tree, they come down and make a little house for themselves in which they live all dry season. After months of living in that little house, they're still alive and make a delicious feast for the natives. I noticed she put for the natives and not for her, that kind of challenge along the way. But it was, and it still is, a dangerous place. And once she wrote about how she arrived at a village and was absolutely exhausted, and she fell asleep. And when she woke up, she was told and shown that they had killed two snakes that were close beside her as she lay fast asleep. And sometimes they would find big snakes like that in their houses as well. Really horrible to find. We go back to the river here. Sometimes the rivers were pretty wild. And once they were going down the river in a big boat, they had a pilot in the boat to help them find their way down. And the big boat got stuck on the rocks and water was coming in. And the pilot, so helpful, jumped out onto a rock. And as he did that, the boat shot off down the river, left him in the middle of the river shouting, I don't know what, but basically tell him to get back and help him. But they were swept right down the river. And one of the natives, when they reached further down, they were able to get a canoe and paddle it back up by themselves and find him still standing in the middle of the river, so glad to see him and get on the canoe and get safely back down the river. After a few years, Janet got pregnant and they had to travel. Janelle, keep this in mind, had to travel 150 miles by foot to Rhodesia. Why any of the adults, why travel to Rhodesia? Trickier question for the adults. Yeah, it's a good answer, but a bit more. Correct, a British colony even. So that he would be born as a British citizen. And so little Robert was born, my dad, out there in Angola. And I kind of imagine what he was like when he was a little boy. Kind of something like this. What fun to live in the jungle. Long before Michael Jackson and Justin Bieber had monkeys, my dad had pet monkey and just had an absolute ball growing up as a wee boy. And I've not got it here, but he's got no imagination. He's never had imagination in his life because as a child, he didn't need any. It was on his doorstep and it was all there to play with and to have such a ball. And he loved traveling down the river in the big boat and smaller boats too. Later on, they were able to get bikes out to them and he would cycle with his dad around all these villages. And I'm just thinking the natives must have just thought, this is so cute, this wee white bundle. Never seen a wee white bundle as they would travel around. So that was the little monkeys. Not so much fun was one of these big things. And this would terrorize the village. It would come and it would take away any goats and animals. And something had to be done. They had to stop the lion. And so my grandpa made a trap and they went up a tree and they set the trap and it went all dark. And then as they were up the tree, they heard as the lion comes padding into the camp. And then a great roar from the lion as its leg got trapped. And up the tree, I'm sure they were shaking by that stage. And they had their spears. And they just managed to kill the lion in time. Because when they got down finally, when the lion stopped moving, they found that it just about got out the trap to get away. But they'd made it. And there's a photo, a slide of a little boy, Robert, sitting on this dead lion. Not looking too comfortable in that situation, but kind of problems we don't really have to deal with. Okay, I need a little volunteer, please. Okay, you come. That is good. Right. One of the chiefs, I'm not going to hurt you, you're okay. There's no wild animals up here. One of the chiefs became a Christian, and over time he was learning more about what being a Christian meant. And one day, when my grandpa was there, he gathered all the slaves together. And he got a chicken. And there was an ex-chicken shortly after that. And they took the blood and they poured it out. And then he took, come over here, he took the blood. And I hope you trust me here. He put it on their forehead like that. And he put it on their earlobe, and he put it on their thumb, and he put it on their big toe. Come on, take a sock off. Okay, what's that all about? What does that mean? What does that mean? Anyone guess? Yeah, they were able to go free. All these slaves that he had, you can take that with you and wipe it all off. Thank you very much for your help. They were now free people. Just as Jesus told us that because he died for us and shed his blood, that covers our sins and we are set free if we ask for forgiveness. But it wasn't all adventure and excitement. Janet became pregnant again, traveled up to Rhodesia, had a little girl, a sister for Robert. But the baby took unwell, and there was no hospitals, and that little baby died out in Africa. Truly heartbreaking for them, so far away from all their friends and their family. Robert was taught at home in out in Africa, but when he reached about 12 and was old enough to go to secondary school, he was sent back to Scotland to stay with various people over in Bell's Hill. Again, they had no idea something else was going to happen. The Second World War broke out. And that meant they didn't see Robert, their son, my dad, from when he was 12 to when he was 18. And so they kept in touch by writing 6 weeks apart. But I'm sure it was really hard for them as time went on. But they were so excited when they finally got back home to catch up with Robert and all that had gone on and how he'd got to university and qualified after that as a dentist as well. It was quite an amazing achievement having grown up out in Africa there. They weren't alone out in Africa. Remember Davy Walker? I told you about him earlier on. He was one of the miners. Well, he became a minister over in Ireland, and when James came back with Janet to Scotland, he would arrange different meetings and take him over to Ireland where they would give reports and people would support them in prayer and in giving as well. And two people out in Ireland that he met were called Emily and Eva, Emily Rowntree and Eva Wark. And they took up the call and thought, yeah, we're going to go out to Africa and join James and Janet. We're going to help teach the kids. We're going to build a small school. And they taught about 50 children 3 days a week. And they had a little clinic, a wee hospital. People would come in the morning. They would hear a gospel message. And they would be treated in the afternoon. I remember as a little boy praying every day for all these different people. And praying for Aunt Emily and Aunt Eva. And sadly, not sadly really, but Emily Rowntree died about 2 months ago out in Africa in her 90s. And Eva Wark is still out there all these years later. Amazing woman. They were both nurses, so they helped to teach and also to look after the natives out in Africa. The people, though, they'd never taken medicine before. What happens if you're ill and the doctor gives you medicine? What do you have to do with it, apart from swallow it? What do you have to do? Not in the fridge. In terms of a course of medicine? Yeah, you've got to take it at the right time and finish it off. And the natives didn't really get that. And so they had to be taught how to take the medicine to help them to get better. A church was built there as well, and many people came to faith. There's a guy who I've met called Kelvin Samwata, and his grandfather was one of those Christians, Africans, who became a Christian through my grandpa out there. And he is now one of the top guys in Zambia, and he's been involved in government, advising government, but he's also now involved in mission throughout different parts of Africa. I wonder if you know who this is, the one on the right. That is David Attenborough. In the mid-1960s, he was out filming about David Livingstone and retracing his steps. He was quite shocked to come across an old white-haired man in his 80s who had spent at that stage nearly 50 years as a missionary. He took a picture of him and he sent it to my dad, and here it is. We have it in our family home. You see, I look a little bit like him, not quite sure. But yeah, it's maybe there somewhere. In his book, David Attenborough recalls meeting him. He says, "In Angola, we stayed with a Scots missionary who was faithfully keeping alight the flame of Livingstone's zeal. 81 years old, he explained his simple, straightforward faith to me. 'I'm not preaching religion,' he told me in a voice that still retained its Glaswegian accent. 'There are hundreds, maybe thousands of religions in the world, but we'll hear none of them. We'll teach the truth as it's written in the scriptures.'" And last year, having read that in my book, my brother wrote to David Attenborough, and David Attenborough wrote back saying that he remembered him and was glad to hear that the work was still going on all these years later. And my grandpa wished that he'd stayed a bit longer, because he was convinced that he would have come to faith at that point. It may still happen, we pray it will happen, but not quite just yet. And someone made up a poster to encourage people to go out there, and this is what it said: "If you have any more James McPhee, send them out. Africa needs them." And Janet died out there, and James had to come back home to get an operation on his eyes for cataracts. And he was told not to go back, so he went back. And that's where he died and was buried out there in Angola. But what an amazing life for just a wee ordinary guy, a big ordinary guy from Bells Hill, not so far from here, who followed in the footsteps of his hero, David Livingstone. And next month, we're going to have a couple of folk coming to church for the 16 pluses to tell you about opportunities to go on mission teams. It might not be to Africa, but to places where people need to hear about Jesus today. And I hope that will also be an inspiration and also encourage you to go. As a church, we want to help you if you want to go off on mission in the summer and continue this work that continues over the ages. Thank you for your patience. Thank you.